Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, everyone. This is Skylines City Metric Podcast, and I'm John Elledge. As you hear this, all being well, unless something has gone horrendously wrong, either with my life or with our travel arrangements, I will be on holiday in France. So this isn't a normal episode of Skylines. This is a kind of holiday special in which, to be honest, I've stolen this idea shamelessly from my former colleague, Caroline Crampton, who took the summer off on her own podcast, which is called She Done It, and it's all about the golden age of murder mysteries, and it's quite a wonderful series, which you should definitely listen to, because Caroline is fantastic. Anyway, what she has done is she's taken the summer off the podcast and got permission from some mates of hers to put out episodes of their podcasts on kind of connected topics. And as someone feeling a little bit overworked these days, that sounded like a lovely idea. So rather than rush out an episode of Skylines, I didn't really have one. What you're going to hear instead is an episode of a podcast called Map Corner. It's hosted and produced by a guy called Royfield Brown, who long-time listeners may remember as our first producer on Skylines, an occasional guest. He was, in fact, the guy who kind of nudged me to do the podcast in the first place. On this particular episode of Map Corner, there is actually an interview with yours truly. So this isn't the last of me you're going to be hearing. I am going to be talking about what it is about maps that I love, and also Helsinki again, randomly. But there's a whole lot more in it than that. They talk a lot about, Royfield and his co-host Claire talk a lot about maps and cities and transport systems and all the kind of stuff we do around here. Basically, if you listen to Skylines, then you will enjoy the sort of stuff they talk about on Map Corner. So shamelessly give myself a bit of time off. I just thought I'd run that. So you should keep listening. And if you enjoy it, you should subscribe to Map Corner as well. But don't unsubscribe from Skylines. We need you. Anyway, all being well, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Happy holidays.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps, brought to you by Royfield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Royfield Brown, who's 37 degrees and 48 minutes north and 122 degrees and 16 minutes west, which puts me in Oakland in California. And as always, I'm joined by the wonderful Claire Asprey.
Hello.
Claire, do you want to know some Oakland facts?
Go on.
Right. Population of Oakland, 425,000. I must admit, I thought it was a little bit more, which means it's the largest city in Alameda County. It's the eighth largest in California. I thought it would have been further up the list, actually. And the 45th largest city in the United States. It just kind of shows you the scale of this place, because 425,000 as a population would put you, what, about sixth in the UK. What would you have bigger than that? Obviously, London, Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow. And then I'm starting to scratch my head. Liverpool, maybe bigger. Leeds, maybe seventh.
Yeah.
Anyway, shows you the size of this country. But folks, Map Corner is the podcast dedicated to the love of maps and kind of to travel and to cities and all things Carter Phillips. So if Peters is your projection, you're in the right place. Claire, what is today's show all about?
Today, we are talking to John Elledge about transport maps, because transport is his great love. And we've got some calls partly on transport from Jane and Glyn. We've also got some really interesting calls around other maps that have taken people's interest. So from Kathy, Pat and Catherine, all talking about maps or features of maps. And then I'll be reviewing what people have been sharing on the social media.
Cool. So it's one of those barnstorming, rip-roaring episodes. And that's basically what you're saying, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Ooh.
Well, not barnstorming in the sense that that's a rurally kind of thing, and we're mainly talking about city metro type maps.
Okay. All right. So rip-roaring, metropolitan and urbanistic type show.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So, folks, just before we commence with the show, why don't you go on to mapcorner.space. It's a slightly funny URL, but it's mapcorner.space. And you can go to our Map Corner shop, because we've had a couple of people actually buy Map Corner mugs. So why don't you join them? So they're not just there by themselves. Two people on planet Earth with Map Corner mugs. Go join them. And I believe there might even be a Map Corner t-shirts. You go on to mapcorner.space, hit shop. Go buy yourself a mug. You'll look incredibly hip and cool. And why don't you post a picture of yourself with your mug when you get it onto social media? Don't forget to review us on Apple Podcasts, folks. It is the ideal way for us to get new recruits, new listeners to Map Corner. Go on there, write us a review, and we will read your name out in a future episode, we promise. First off, we always start the show with a little bit of an interview. John Elledge is a little bit of a pal of mine, and is a proper map nerd, and he runs a website all about maps and mapping. Here's our conversation. John.
Hello there.
I've always held you in great esteem, sir, because you do...
Glad someone else.
Well, I'm sure there are many people. You do what I always wanted to do as a kid. You make a living out of maps. How is such a thing possible?
I haven't got the faintest idea. I mean, how much backstory do you want here? Basically, the idea was handed down on from on high by the owner of the New Statesman that we should do something about cities and about how cities work. And so I was hired to launch that. And about literally the second day the website was up, well, firstly, it stopped being up. It fell over again instantly, as things tend to do if you kind of announce them without beta testing and so on. Mm. So I was very frustrated and shouting at the sky. And to kind of relieve the tension and give myself something to do while the techies did their thing, I found a proposal in some Transport for London document for what it termed the R25, like it's a railway loop around London. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at this map thinking, I think I can work out which lines that is it's connecting there. So I did a kind of like, you know, the sort of maps you get in a tube carriage showing you what stations the line serves. Yeah. And I made one of this kind of R25 proposal. And when the web, I then posted it when the site came back up, and it just, the traffic on it just went mental. And like, you know, it kind of sparked with the audience in a way nothing else had before. So it's like, okay, clearly this is going to be a website about maps. So
it didn't exactly start off that way, because I was trying to figure out, when I was thinking of City Metric earlier, because that's the website that we're talking about. So when I was looking at City Metric earlier, I thought, did somebody take pity on you and say, this guy is just like so weird that we need to just build a whole job around him? or is this kind of like nerd outreach? So which one out of the two is it?
I mean, it was sort of neither. Like, I wasn't doing this kind of stuff before. It's not like I was. I mean, I did a little bit of this kind of stuff for a website called Londonist, which I was a contributing editor on as a sideline for a long time. But my day job before City Metric was very different. It was editing a business magazine for companies in the education sector, so it had absolutely nothing to do with this kind of nerdy map stuff at all. But I got hired for reasons that had, you know, it was a little bit because I'd done this sort of thing for Londonist, but it was also because I was just kind of in the mix of someone who was freelancing for the New Statesman, and it just my then boss Helen Lewis just sort of thought I might be a good fit for this job. But I wasn't. It's not like I was like sat there sort of making these, like, posting about maps on my own time, or like, you know, trying to write about the tube the whole time. It was something I'd done occasionally for a different website, but it wasn't a day job.
But that then somewhat disappoints me, because I was going to say to this day I still draw maps, that'd be a gross exaggeration. But I put you down completely as one of those kind of, dyed in the wool kind of like map heads that, you know, is always wondering about, well, you know, why don't we extend the tube line here, and gets out a bit of pen and paper and a felt tip pen and whatever, and I kind of gets going. But you're telling me
I did that sort of stuff a little bit when I was a nerdy little kid, but it wasn't something I'd ever considered, like, this might be something, you know. I it was a pleasant surprise with that kind of post about the sort of London orbital rail thing I just described. It was a pleasant surprise to find out that there is actually an audience for this stuff. There are people who kind of just really like these kind of speculative maps of metro networks. So even though City Metric is meant to be sort of, you know, a factual site, it's been kind of a rich vein of content for us to do, like, you know, fantasy metro networks for cities that don't have them. And it's kind of self-generating as well, because you run a couple of these things and then people keep sending them to you. So,
what do you think it is about us people that love maps, us cartophiles, that we like imaginary maps, we like speculative maps, we like to, have our own version of the map? What do you think it says about us and about our obsession?
I mean, I think the appeal of maps generally is the kind of the density of data, like the amount of information you get in one flat image, plus the ability to kind of, you know, pinpoint yourself on it. Like my grand unified theory of where, like, there is so much web traffic invariance on London's tube map is there are 9 million people in London, so there are 9 million different conceptions of this city and where the important places are and what it means and what this kind of place represents and so on. The one thing that everyone will have in common, no matter how old they are, where they are sort of, you know, economically and so on, is the tube map. It's the single point of reference that everyone can kind of coalesce around. So I think it's partly just, you know, people like kind of, you know, sort of what if narratives, but it's partly also it's a sort of way of, like, imagining changes to the city rather than the map in itself. It's like, you know, well, imagine if there was a tube line that went to Peckham or something. It is a thing that people can kind of, like, think about how it would reshape the city and their conception of it.
And you have one of your big obsessions, apart from maps, actually is trains as well. So this is like a perfect storm for you, isn't it? A metro map or a transit map?
I mean, the not really.
The answer, John, is yes.
I pretend to like trains on the internet. I mean, I like travelling by trains. I think they're a great method of transport. But my interest in trains is sort of a subset of the interest in maps. I'm not actually someone who gets a kick out of, like, you know, different types of train or different engine models or anything like that. It is sometimes quite useful for sort of traffic purposes to pretend to be that person on the internet.
Well, you had me completely and utterly fooled. I thought you had a cagoule, an anorak, all that kind of stuff, and a little note. And you're at the end of the platform, you know, like noting what engines had gone by. I really thought you were that person. You have the look of that type of person, John, to be fair.
Hey, so this is you asked me to come on this podcast and they're just bloody insulting me.
It's called Bants. Gentle banter.
I have recently, about 8 months ago now, I moved to a new flat which overlooks a railway junction, which was not, like, this is not something I went looking for. I think it meant it probably means that the building is slightly cheaper than similarly nice flats would be that didn't overlook railway junctions. And it was quite convenient that I can sort of enjoy the fact that I can see trains go past all the time and it doesn't bother me that it's a bit noisy and so on. But it's not something I specifically went looking for. I just kind of made it a bit cheaper.
Mm. The London Tube map is absolutely iconic. What is it about transit maps, do you think, that... Well, you've kind of mentioned it slightly before. It's about the density of data, but also the extraneous data being removed. And then there is this kind of perfect mulch, isn't there, of graphics and typeface and colour.
I mean, when done well, they're very beautiful things. Mm. But I think it is largely that, you know, the city as an idea is so complicated. And a metro map just sort of boils it down to its sort of, you know, essentials to, like, you know, here are how all the places kind of interconnect to each other. And even though, like, they're inherently a little bit misleading, it gives you a sense of the shape of the city in a way that, like, if you kind of look at sort of a full-blown street map or something, it can be a bit overwhelming. But if you look at a metro map, you have a sense that, you know, okay, here's the financial district and here's where the entertainment is and here's how you get to the suburbs and so on. It just kind of, like, condenses it down to something you can kind of take in at a glance.
Mm. And they become, and they're totally totemic and iconic for that city, aren't they? Like, you can't, when you think of London, in terms of graphic form, it could be the course of the Thames, it could be the underground logo, you know, the red kind of circle with a blue line. But and definitely the tube maps there. There are certain things which just fundamentally, subconsciously, just say London. Even like the colour red on a bus just says London. And the tube map is definitely there. So London's came first, Henry Beckley. We know all of that. Which city does it badly?
Oh, there's a question. I don't know if I can immediately think of a city that does it badly. I mean, I actually had one of my sort of heresies is I think the London Tube map is terrible these days. I think it's lost a lot of the simplicity that made it an attractive prospect in the first place. But like different cities do it completely differently. Like Paris, for example, doesn't really kind of stick to the line about the rule about, you know, 45 degree angles and so on, because the system is just too complicated. It just wouldn't fit that model. So it has a slightly different approach. I've always found something that kind of quite irritates me about the Chicago transit map for the elevated railway is that the station names tend to refer to the junctions. It'll be, I'm going to get the names wrong, but it could be like Lake/State. It's the junction of Lake Street and State Street or whatever. Those two streets probably don't interconnect. But, you know, it's that kind of format. But the map simplifies it and only includes the first one of those, which means that on the Chicago transit map there are three different stations just labeled Chicago, which I find a little bit irritating, and I think that's kind of unhelpful if you're a tourist or something. Yeah, just, oh, maybe by Chicago station. It's like, well, which one?
So your boss down at New Statesman Towers says, John, we need you to go to some far-flung city somewhere, all expenses paid. They throw you on an airplane. You jump off.
You've got a very old fashioned idea of how much money there is in journalism, I've got to say. But yeah, it's something like
that. You know what it is? John, I'm a romantic. That's what it is. Yeah. I'm a romantic.
It's more like someone asks me if I'll go to their conference and says, "Oh, we'll pay for it," and that's how I get to go to far flung places.
Ah.
So we got to go to Finland the other week. That was fun.
Well, tell me about Helsinki. Tell me about the city. Tell me about, your first impressions of Helsinki, and then also about its metro map, if it even has one.
So, I mean, Helsinki, it was, I liked it. It was kind of, it looked more sort of Russian than I was expecting, or at least someone with me who has been to Russia told me it looked more kind of Russian than Scandinavian or Eastern European. It's very wide boulevards. It's not a very dense city. There's kind of a lot of space. It has a single metro line that's only about 10, 20 years old, I think. But what it does have that's very nice is trams, these beautiful green and gold things. that are that, you know, absolutely stunning looking things that cover the city quite nicely, and they just look gorgeous. I know I just keep repeating myself, but yeah, I'm a big fan of trams as a kind of method of getting around a smaller city. The only slight downside to them is they're quite difficult to get onto if you're in any way mobility impaired or you've got a pushchair or something like that. So that's not great. But from a purely aesthetic point of view, they're wonderful.
Well, it surprises me that they're going to be hard to get onto. I would have thought that, now let me get my Scandinavians and my Nordics in the right way around.
Finland is Nordic, but not Scandinavian.
Country, that's correct. Yes. Woo, I got it right. I thought those folks went big in for access and all that malarkey.
I think it's just that it's quite an old system. So, like, you've got to remember this is a relatively recent phenomenon, that it's something that is considered at all in the planning system. So on City Metric a couple of years ago, we actually did a piece about how there is a version of the London tube map that's kind of the accessible version. Like, I mean, like the main one now does kind of show which stations you can get into in a wheelchair and so on. But there is a version that just shows the bits that you can access if you're in a wheelchair, and obviously it's a much reduced system, but it's still, you know, it's still quite significant. You can get to a lot of the stations. Someone did a version of the same kind of map for the Paris Metro, most of which is sort of, you know, 80, 90, 100 years old, and it's literally just the one line. It's line 14, which opened in the 90s, is the only accessible line, because most of them, generally, you have to go up and down a lot of stairs to get to the Paris Metro, because it just wasn't considered in the planning. So it's a relatively recent thing that actually people building these systems are like, you know, we need people in wheelchairs and with pushchairs to be able to get onto these things as well. So I assume it's just the trams in Helsinki predate that phenomenon.
So wide boulevards, more Russian than Nordic or Scandinavian than you would have thought. What else was a big surprise about going to Helsinki? Because I must admit, my innate knowledge of Helsinki is just about zero. I can find it on a map, but that's just about it, really.
So it's a very it's all on waterfront. Like, we went to the one of the main parks with the Sibelius monument in it, and we were sat having a nice drink by what looked like a sort of, well, almost like a pond rather than a lake, maybe a lake, but you know, it didn't look like that big a body of water. And it was only when we looked at a map and you realised it was actually the pond turned into a lake, which turned into an inlet, which turned into the Baltic. You know, this was the edge of the sea, but it didn't look like it. It could have been a pond in any municipal park in the world. So the fact it's all built on water was quite interesting. The other thing that surprised me was actually not about the city itself, but about Finland more generally, which is its history. It only really starts in about 1300, because before then, it's still this sort of prehistoric era. There's kind of no written texts or anything. There's a small population there, but there's kind of no sort of sense of, you know, this is a country with its own history. And it's only really when the Swedes invade in about 1300 that it sort of becomes a place. And it's just one of those things that you don't really think about, the idea that history starts at totally different times in different parts of the world. I found quite interesting.
You know, I can't remember what I was reading about Finland, and that occurred to me that, you know, you kind of have a sense of a potted history if you're a bit of a geographic or historical nerd of most European countries, you know, and Finland is a bit of a blank slate, and you've really outlined the reason in that it's kind of settled. Notional history, it comes relatively late.
And also it was dominated by other countries for most of its history. So the Swedes arrive in about 1300. For 500 years it's part of the Swedish Empire. Then in one of the sort of big northern wars in sometime in the 18th or early 19th century, I think, Sweden and Russia go to war. Sweden loses. Russia's prize is to take Finland, so for the next century, it's essentially a Russian province.
Grand Duchy, even.
And it's only really with the Russian Revolution in 1917 that Finland breaks away and becomes an independent state. So on one level, Finland is only 102 years old, you know?
where are you going next? So you've done Helsinki. Where else? If I have a conference, where would you like that conference to be, John?
Oh, I don't know. Where haven't I been? I'd like to see more of Italy. I don't think I've ever been to a Spanish city and not fallen in love with it and started trying to work out how to move there. And it always passes, but genuinely, the Spanish build cities incredibly well. They've all got these sort of lovely pedestrianised centres with, like, you know, these big squares with people sat around drinking and eating tapas in them all night.
I must admit, I was somewhat surprised when I first went to Madrid just how actually urban it was. And that sounds like a really naff thing to say. But have you ever been to Lisbon?
I've not, no.
Lisbon is how I imagine Madrid to be. Lisbon is slightly more down at heel, more fading paint, crumbling architecture, a little bit more Victorian, whereas Madrid is just thrusting and modern. I was surprised with Madrid. I thought when I went to Lisbon, I went, oh, that's how I imagined Madrid to be. Anyway, I upended you, and I know you've got
Spain is sort of one of the big economic success stories of Europe the last... I mean, like, you know, when we were kids, it was still a fascist regime until some point in the 70s.
75,
when you were
a
kid, I wasn't around yet.
Yeah, thank you.
Because you're old. Just reminding everyone how old you are. But, you know... It's only after that that it starts sort of developing into a sort of, you know, modern Western European country. But it's now a pretty rich country. And especially after Brexit, I think it's probably going to be richer than us. So, and they get the weather and the food as well. It's really very unfair.
Right. So I'm not going to do a conference in Italy. I'm not going to do one in Spain. Third chance, and then we can say goodbye to you. We've done City Metric, we've done Transit Maps, we've done Helsinki, love of Spain, you're not that much into trains yet. So give us one other country or city, and then we can round up there, and then we can go on with the rest of our Map Corner show. Go.
You know, actually, I think the place that I'd most like to find an excuse to visit is where you are right now. I've never been to the west coast of the US. I'm not going to come see you. Don't get me wrong. I've travelled around a lot of the US because I've covered a couple of elections out there.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, I've been in the sort of northeastern corner. Like, I've made it as far west as like Chicago, and as far south as North Carolina, and I've been to Florida, and I've been to New Orleans, and I've been to Texas. I've never been to the West at all. And particularly, like, I don't think I'll like Los Angeles, but I sort of feel I should see it. Mm-hmm. And I think I probably would like San Francisco, even if I couldn't afford to spend much time there. So I'd probably like to see that bit of the world, to be honest.
No, it's funny that I landed up in San Francisco in large part because I'm an urbanist, and San Francisco is always cited as the city which is the most European on the West Coast. And, you know, the city centre, kind of like core, absolutely, well, it's American, but yes, it's very walkable. That's the thing. That's when they say it's European, I mean, it's very walkable, unlike a lot of American cities, unlike LA. So I've actually been to San Diego, Sacramento, San Jose, on the West Coast, Seattle, which is absolutely gorgeous, and Portland, which is totally charming. I've never been to Los Angeles, but, you know, because it's just urban sprawl, and I've never had the desire to go. However, I will be going in a couple of weeks for the first time to a conference, funnily enough.
I have actually heard, like, friends who I wouldn't have expected to like it said they enjoyed it more than they thought. It weirds me out. It's sort of a city with no centre, isn't it? It is just like a bunch of these kind of, you know, small cities or big towns that run into each other. And you need a car to get anywhere, which I'm not wild about. But you're from Birmingham, so you're probably used to that. So maybe you'll love it.
Stop it. We are getting so much better in Brum, with our lack of a dependence on the car. And, you know, to pull our whole kind of conversation back 360, we have our new tram. So we do have now a metro system, and which is expanding. And they are downgrading the roads in the city centre. It can't happen soon enough. But John Elledge, Funnily enough, I have a conference in San Francisco, which I'm putting on early 2020. So you never know. You might get an invite. So then you can come out, break bread with me, and give us an audio postcard of your first impressions of the Bay Area. But I know you've got to go, mate. But listen, thank you for coming on to Map Corner and just shooting the breeze. We didn't really have anything really to talk about other than just stuff, really. But
yeah,
thank
it's never
you.
Stopped us before, has it? It's good to talk to you. Look after yourself.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Claire, and I'm reporting in today from the garden of my uncle's house on the edge of Perth in Western Australia. We're kind of near Darlington. To tell you about a place that we went to visit, which was the first place we went to see in Western Australia. First night we arrived, we were talking about things to do, and the subject of the Mundaring Weir and the pipeline came up. And I was just fascinated by the story behind this. And also quite interested that we'd never heard of it. And I know it's in Australia, and Australia is a long way away, and Perth is a long way away, even for most of the rest of Australia. But, you know, we had a fair amount of, you know, industrial heritage history growing up. You know, Victorian engineers, Brunel and people like that, you know, they've loomed large in terms of people I've heard of. And yet I'd never heard of C.Y. O'Connor, who did some fantastic projects, including Fremantle Harbour here in Western Australia, a lot of projects in New Zealand, but most famously this impossible project, which was the Goldfields Pipeline. And this was a mechanism to bring water to the goldfields at Kalgoorlie and Coolgardie in Western Australia. Well, they had gold, but they couldn't do anything about it because there was no water. So he built a pipe, and the pipe goes over 300 miles, like 330 miles, from the edge of Perth and the reservoir at Mundaring, all the way to the goldfields. And as we drove up to Mundaring Weir, we could see the pipe, and the pipe sort of weaves sort of one side of the road, and the road, it's in the hills, so the road's sort of moving up and down and weaving around, and the pipeline sort of is one side and another. And it's a very simple look. It's a metal pipe. It was painted white, mostly the bits that we saw. And it's less than a metre wide. It just sits above the ground, maybe, I don't know, about a foot or so above the ground. And it just goes on and on and on. And you can sort of see it, and you trace it along as you go by. And it seems such a simple thing. But obviously, moving water for 300 miles is no mean feat. And I think there are 9 pumping stations along the route. We went to see the pumping station number 1, which is just by the weir, and is now a sort of museum to the whole project, which is now run by the local water authority. And it was such a beautiful place, and a real beautiful kind of Victorian industrial architecture. I'll post some pictures. And then the weir itself and the dam was so pretty. You could walk across the dam and look up across the reservoir. There were loads of signs warning about kangaroos. Apparently there's a lot of kangaroos in the area. We didn't see any, much to my daughter's disappointment, although it was the middle of the day. It wasn't really kangaroo time. They've really made an effort to emphasise, obviously, in a very dry place, such the importance of water and how, you know, this is such an important project. And it now continues over 100 years later to supply water to over 100,000 people who completely depend on it. And I don't know, maybe it was a cynic in me, saw this pipe and I just thought, oh God, in theory, it would be so easy to, like, disrupt that supply. But it just goes about its business and delivers the water and no one seems to cause any trouble. So, yeah, I think it has had the occasional burst and so on. My uncle was telling me stories about what they did to deal with when the pipe got a hole in it and started shooting water up in the air, which must have been such an tricky thing to do, because it's under quite a lot of pressure to get all that way. But yeah, it was such a just a really peaceful setting. And I have to say, the kind of the Perth Hills generally, really nice place. Do you recommend it if you're ever in Australia and you want to go to Western Australia? I recommend the Perth Hills. Just a really sad note on this, which is that C.Y. O'Connor, who's the chief engineer who oversaw the project. And, you know, it was commissioned 1896, and it finished in 1903. So like that seems quite quick for a major infrastructure project. I don't know, these days those things take, you know, decades. But it came under a lot of criticism because it seemed so impossible. And he actually killed himself before the pipeline was completed, and not long before, actually. And he never saw it finished, which is such a terrible shame, because he had some amazing achievements, including the harbour at Fremantle. So, yeah, well done, C.Y. O'Connor. And great to see that pipeline still delivering on its original aims.
You know, I've never been further east than Israel, though I'm hoping to put that right in the next month or so, and I have a trip planned to Vietnam and to Hong Kong. But tell us about Perth. What's the first impression you get when you go there?
Perth was our first stop in Australia, and we have family there. So we were there less as tourists, I guess, and more as a family visit. So it was quite, I suppose, new worldy, I suppose I could say. It was reminiscent of like Canada, I guess, in the kind of space and the layout, and the weather was just right when we were there, which was perfect. And we were staying up in the Perth Hills.
Do you say the weather was perfect?
Ha 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 ha, very good, very good.
Nice.
So it was, I mean, we didn't see a huge amount of Perth, but we saw a little bit of, some of the things that there were to see in the area. And we really enjoyed a trip to Penguin Island, which was a little island where penguins live, because they have penguins in Australia. And, that was just beautiful, really, really lovely. And we saw, dolphins swimming in the bay, and you know, the pelicans were amazing. I've never imagined quite how big a pelican is until I saw them really close up. Phenomenal birds. Like, you can really see the kind of connections to dinosaurs, really, when you see them at that scale. So that was interesting. And it was, going to downtown Perth was like, yeah, really, it felt like a modern city. And then we went down this little bit, and people who've been there will know this. It's a little sort of quaint alleyway, sort of Elizabethan, sort of Shakespearean-themed alleyway with all these little shops. Real pastiche, oldie England stuff. But it's a bit of a tourist trap, full of, tourism shops and so on. But it's just interesting how when you're creating a cityscape, you need that blend of, you know, big open spaces and modern buildings and something that feels older. And I guess in a new country like Australia, how people feel about things that are older is, it's a bit of a mixed bag. And I think what I've really noticed from my time there was how the efforts being made, belatedly so, around honouring the original heritage of the people who were there first. And I think obviously there's still room to improve on that, but it was really noticeable how in aspects of sort of official life or signage or whatever, there was a clear kind of recognition of the people whose land that was first round. And I heard that over and over again from the friends and family that I visited in Australia, who were clearly really interested and kind of patriotic about the Aboriginal heritage, even though they weren't from that background themselves. So that was really promising.
Do you get a real sense when you're in Perth that it is, the other end of the rest of Australia?
I don't know. I think because we were travelling and we weren't anywhere for very long and we were flying from one place to another, I guess it feels like part of the whole for me, but I imagine that's quite different. And there is a sense of that people could have go there, and there isn't much further to go from there. Although that said, if you go up to the northern territories from Perth and into the Kimberleys and beyond, that really is the back of beyond, I think, in many ways. Mm. So it, you know, it felt like a modern city, much like other places where I've been to. That's a modern city, feels like a modern city, but you know, I wasn't there long enough to pick up on some of that nuance, I guess.
When you talk about heading north in Western Australia on the way to the Northern Territories, I've always been fascinated by the Hutt River Principality, which is this self-declared micronation. Do you know about it?
No.
Yeah, so this is the basic story as I understand it. And I first bumped into this in the 70s watching Wicker's World. Do you remember Alan Wicker used to go around the world?
Yeah. And like moustache, yeah. Lovely hat.
Yep. In a way, we are the bastard stepchild of Wicker's World, kind of doing Map Corner, in a way. So for people that don't know Alan Wicker, he was a British celebrity who used to go around the world and film himself interviewing interesting people in exotic climes. And the one episode which really stuck out for me was he went to Hutt River in Western Australia, which had declared independence from the state of Australia in the late 60s and declared itself a principality. And the ruler was a guy called Prince Leonard. And basically, he didn't want to pay his taxes to the government of, I can't remember if it was Western Australia or to Australia, but either way, it was a tax dispute. So he declared independence, started issuing his own money, stamps. So the principality is fundamentally just the family farm. But he does have his sons, or he did have his sons. And I think the population was, I don't know, I'm going to say 20 or 30. And because this is Western Australia, this is actually quite large in terms of acreage or square miles, I should say. And the Australian government have basically just given him a bit of a pass. So he issues, because I believe he died a few years ago now, but they issue.
Well, he only
passports.
Died earlier this year, by the looks of it. I'm just checking him out.
Look at you and your Google skills. They issue passports. They've got their own money, and there are the odd country around the world that actually recognises the Hutt River Principality, and they basically survive off tourism. It's one of these quirky micronations of which the government, the country of which they sit, has just gone, you know what, just do your own thing. We're not really going to push this. But yes, so I've always said to myself, if I ever go to Western Australia, I will go to the Hutt River Principality and get a stamp in my passport from there. But anyway, Claire, we have calls, and we should crack on with them. So from one bit of the Commonwealth to another, here is Jane speaking about Vancouver, I believe.
Yeah. Hello, Map Corner. It's Jane Older calling in about the Metro theme. I would like to recommend the SkyTrain system in Vancouver because it is very futuristic in a 50s sci-fi sense. It's driverless and electric, so it whirs. It's elevated monorail. And it has a human announcer that sounds like a robot. But it's also futuristic in the terms of still being expanded. So it has new routes and the map expands, unlike the London Underground map, which feels very static. The line from the airport to the city centre was opened for the 2010 Olympics, Winter Olympics. And it goes from elevated to underground like a slow-motion roller coaster. And because there's no driver, you can sit at the front at the window and ride it like a roller coaster.
Oh, is that the end of our Jane?
I think it is.
Oh, thank you for Jane. You know what, Claire? One of the themes of this show, we do need a sign-off, you know. We absolutely do. People, we need to know when people have spent and when they're basically there's no more of them to come.
Yes. Didn't we agree about something to do with folding up a map?
Well, this is a theme that I reckon, right, I'm just going to defer to you. You need to say what exactly the sign-off is and also what the greeting is, because another caller has actually say, I don't know what the hell's going on here. How do I even start as a first-time caller into Map Corner? But anyway, monorails, the future of public transport, discuss.
And I think, well, anyone who's been to London and been on the driverless trains out in the Docklands Light Railway can sort of a bit identify with that feeling. And again, large sections of that are actually elevated and, you know, sort of looking out on the world, and you can do it from the very front of the train, which feels, yeah, futuristic in a 50s sort of way, I guess. So that's always quite fun. I think everyone's got their own form of favourite urban transport, perhaps. And I would say there's something very, something like that feels very neat about any sort of transit system, like underground system, whatever, where you do have those schematic rather than real maps. And I think it's much easier to do those for any rail system as opposed to like a bus network or whatever. Although trams, I suppose, operate a slightly middle ground. Certainly when I lived in Holland, we had the most amazing tram system in Amsterdam, and it was the point where you didn't ever have to know when the tram was. You could just go out and there would be one along any minute. Mm. And, you know, that's when public transport really works. And I think what's really interesting is to see some of these places now that are starting to make public transport free, and, you know, really drive the change for people to get out of their cars and use public transport. I know there are, I can't remember where they are, but I think a couple of cities in France that have done it. And, you know, obviously it costs money to completely subsidise your transport network, but then you get benefits elsewhere. And I think that's quite an interesting concept, which a political local government geek like John Elledge would know that is pretty much impossible everywhere but a very few handful of places in the UK, because the deregulation of bus services and the lack of control that local city halls have over most of the public transport in the area that they oversee. But that's quite a niche public sector local government piece of information there. But it's one that John would appreciate, I'm sure.
Monorails are the past vision of the future, aren't they? There is something about a monorail.
There's one at Gatwick Airport, isn't there, as well?
Yeah, yeah. And there's also that Simpsons episode where a huckster comes to town and says, you know, we're going to get Springfield into the future. We're going to build a monorail. You know, and he comes, you know, resplendent in a straw hat, and he's like some 1920s huckster. It's a great episode. I went to Seattle for the first time last year, and I absolutely love Seattle. Seattle, beautiful, beautiful city, incredibly clean, in stark contrast to San Francisco and the Bay Area. And they famously have a monorail which only has two stops, and it was built in the early 1960s, so, you know, peak monorail time.
That sounds like a real kind of Olympic Games white elephant type thing.
It's exactly it. It's
really
only used by tourists. It was built for a World's Fair,
right?
And it just goes from one place to another, and people just get on it because Seattle is famous for having its monorail. It's famous for its kind of that needle building, but also its monorail. Mm-hmm. And it is fundamentally just like a white elephant, but has become a tourist attraction. So, you know, they can have their uses even if they don't actually physically go anywhere where people need to go from home to work, et cetera, or for recreation. And it's not even a mile long. You know, so, but it's been there for 50 odd years, and some 7,000 tourists travel on it each day.
Wow.
So Seattle and its monorail.
I remember being in Barcelona with some friends, a friend of mine who was working at, is it West Midlands Metro? Or anyway, she worked in the sort of the metro system in the West Midlands, and she spent her life trying to get people to take public transport. And we insisted on using every form of public transport in Barcelona in the 2 days that we were there as a group. And I particularly remember the funicular railway. Also, there was a thing, or was it a cable car or something like that? Anyway, but there was something a bit different that you couldn't normally get in a city. So we were trying every different type of transport there was to be had.
Mm-hmm. We in Brum in the West Midlands, we've had the West Midlands Metro for some years now, but it did just travel on train lines, and it's only been in 2016 that then they built it, so it actually goes into the centre of Birmingham now. So it does go across, it goes down Corporation Street, goes up Snow Hill. And it's funny how trams, and we need to get somebody on to talk about this in depth, have gone from being something you wanted to get off your streets in the 1940s and 50s because cars were seen as being the future, mm-hmm. and being much more flexible. But now they are the thrusting sign of the future, yeah. aren't they? If you almost feel like Birmingham and the West Midlands have got a tram because they feel left behind. You know, you need a tram system to at least be on the map, to be a modern Western city almost. So, and it's interesting because this tram is being built now, you know, where it's going. So at the moment, it from Wolverhampton, it goes on the train line to Snow Hill in Birmingham. It goes through the Jewellery Quarter, it gets to Snow Hill, then it goes on the road down Corporation Street, which is literally devoid of traffic now. And then it snakes round the new Street Station, and it's going up by the Town Hall, and it's going along Broad Street, and it's going to go back out. And there are plans, if HS2 happens in Birmingham, for there to be a second line. And it has to be said, it is, you know, you walk down the streets in Birmingham, you see this tram, you're like, ooh, I'm somewhere now. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a feeling that this sleek modern thing whizzing by feels all kind of thrusting, and like, you know, the economy of the city is burgeoning. However, one of the things that I absolutely love about San Francisco is, so they have a real mishmash of public transport. So they have the Bay Area Rapid Transport System, the BART, which is in effect what we'd call the tube, the underground. So it goes underground. Then they have the Moonie, which are electric, let's call them trams, but they're new. I want to say new, and they're built in the last 20 years or so. And then they have electric buses, or at least carbon neutral buses. There is such a difference between the two. I don't know. But what they do have on some of their tram lines are, forgetting the trolley cars that everybody knows San Francisco is kind of famous for, that fundamentally go up two routes of a steep hill. And these trolley cars are fundamentally the same ones which have been in use since the early 1900s. They actually have vintage trams which the city have bought from other cities which were decommissioned. So you get these beautiful 1940s trams from places like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh running on San Francisco's tram lines. And they specifically go on the Embarcadero up to Fisherman's Wharf. And they are a little bit of a tourist thing, but regular people do catch them. So there's this one which goes from the Castro, which is the gay area, which is maybe 2 miles in from the downtown, goes down Market Street. And you want to jump on it because it just looks absolutely great. And again, it's that the past version of the future. You know, it's a sleek 1940s version of something which is aerodynamic. And very sleek, yeah. But they're incredibly beautiful, and all of them are different colours. And when you get in them, it very clearly says, so this tram is from Philadelphia, it was built in 1948. And there's even one which is built in either Milan or Turin, I can't remember, from about the 1908. And it's just wonderful. And I love the idea of cities almost creating heritage in that way. If you're an 8-year-old boy or girl, you want to jump on that tram because they just look incredibly beautiful and wonderful. Like you're going to have an adventure, but also they have a purpose. And then also they're cementing a very distinctive image of that town for tourists as well. It's the one thing about the Birmingham's trams. They are featurelessly slick. And I did say to a friend of mine some time ago, it would have been a stroke of genius. Birmingham City Council or the West Midlands Metro Authority had put some vintage trams on them, because no surer way is there than that, than to get a whole load of tourism into the town and to get little kids jumping on them and screaming at the mum and dads to get them on that old thing, and to ding the bell.
Oh, I like a modern sleek tram myself. I think there's something very beautiful about the new ones. And like the Nottingham tram, for example. And actually the Manchester ones as well. I quite like those.
Mm. When I lived in Manchester in the early 80s, the early 90s is when they'd just finished the first line of the Manchester Metro. But they are still expanding that.
Right, quite possibly.
Anyway, we're wittering. How's about we go on to Glyn? Because I believe he schooled you.
Oh, yeah, we're moving from public transport back to roads. But, Glyn is here to explain the thing I was trying to tell everyone last time round that I had remembered badly from something someone told me 10 years ago or 20 years ago. and he's here to tell it much, much clearer than I did about road numbering in the UK.
Hello, Map Corner. It's Glyn here. Hello, Royfield. Hello, Claire. And I will be known to some of your listeners through Dumpty Dum. I'm currently calling in from 51 degrees and 27.1 minutes north, 0 degrees and 12.7 minutes west. Royfield asked me to call in on the road numbering that was discussed in the last podcast in relation to the UK. And it's based on the A road network. So the A1 runs north from London to Edinburgh, the A2 down to Dover, the A3 to Portsmouth, the A4 to Bristol, the A5 to Holyhead, the A6 to Carlisle, and then the A7, A8 and A9 used to run also from Edinburgh. And then between the A1 and the A2, all roads with numbers begin with a 1, between the A2 and the A3 with a 2, and so on. I get a little bit confused in Scotland because of where between the A7 and the A1, where they all begin with a 6, but that's the basic principle. And most of those A roads still exist, although I think the A8 has been more or less absorbed into the M8 in Scotland, and you will find it difficult to find the A5 and the A6 in the southeast because it's often been absorbed into a motorway or renumbered something else. There are some interesting A roads, such as the A38 and the A34, which both start in the south of England and then go to various points in the Midlands or the north. The A38 sort of finishes in Mansfield. I'd love to know what the civil servant who was doing the numbering decided why a road should end in Mansfield. So the numbering of motorways, that obviously followed all the numbering of the A roads and other roads. And the motorways generally taken their number from the nearest A road that goes in roughly the same direction. So as the M1 goes north, follows roughly the same track as the A1. The M4 west, same as the A4. The M3 goes southwest, roughly the same as the A3. M5, definitely an anomaly, doesn't seem to go anywhere near the A5. M25... along its southern course, it runs very close to the A25. I suspect that's where the numbering came from there. Yes, I think that's about, that's all about, I have to say on road numbering, which is probably a great relief for your listeners. Really enjoying the Map Corner podcast. Thanks to all involved in its production and hope it continues for a very long time. Goodbye.
Can I just say, right, so Glyn said at the very start that I told him to call, right, and that sounded like the answer that you gave in the previous episode wasn't good enough. So I went, Glyn, just sort this out. It's because he did a rather good post on our Facebook page that I says, dude, why don't you just like call up and say all of that? So that, just want to clear that up, whatever, first off.
I think you assume I take offence more than I actually do.
Well, I just making sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So where are we actually with the signing on and signing off? Why don't you just like lay the rule now, right? I know somebody's going to mention it in a call. Well, you know what? Let's just, I'm going to hold my horses. Wait till she mentions it in a call, and then, Claire, you can definitively tell us who's folding a map, who's going ahoy or whatever, right? Here is Kath, and I believe she's from the Czech Republic.
Hi, this is Kathy calling in from the Czech Republic. I posted a map this month of called the Carbon Map, which I think is a great example of how maps can be used to show information. It's also quite cool because it doesn't just colour in areas, but it shows them as different sizes. So, like, the areas, depending on what you choose, you can set it to show different things. But it can show which parts of the world are emitting the most carbon or consuming the most carbon. And it can also be coloured in different ways, so you can have more than one variable at the same time. I wonder, do you have a map that shows information that's a favourite of yours that can be used maybe for campaigning or just making people aware of things? Also, on a completely different note, I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm at the moment, and that reminded me that one of my favourite maps to look at this time of year during the summer is lightningmaps.org, where they give you a real-time picture of where lightning is striking any time in the world. And it means that if it's really hot and you feel like a storm must be coming, you can look and see the storm approaching you. Or you can just look at any part of the world and see where they've got storms at the moment. Enjoy. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you go first?
Okay, so I definitely recommend people look at the carbon map because it's a really interesting way of showing where all of the carbon's being created, who are most vulnerable. Often, you won't be surprised to hear, the people who are not creating all the carbon. And I'm just looking at a map now about, you know, the change in CO2 emissions and to see how some places are coming down, but obviously not by as much as the people that are going up. And, of course, a lot of the developing world is increasing its carbon emissions. But, you know, they started from a very low base. So, you know, that's to be expected, I guess. But I also do want to make a kind of call out for Cathy's suggestion around the lightning strike map, because I've spent the last two or three nights of this week in a sweltering UK where we've had storms and rumblings, and I think it was Tuesday night we had lightning for hours. It was just really, really stormy, and looking at the lightning map is so interesting, and you can track it in real time, or you can track it sort of like back an hour or back 24 hours, and you can see what was happening kind of the previous day, or you can watch what's happening like in the moment and see where the lightning is and if it's getting closer to you. So I very much enjoyed looking at that map this week. It's a really, yeah, I don't know who gets the data for it. I'm not quite sure how you know where lightning is striking at any point to put it on immediately in a real-time map. I mean, there's something about the technology that allows that to happen, which is mind-blowing to me. I'm guessing it comes from some kind of meteorological society or something. I don't know. I haven't looked into it, but it's just fascinating. And because it's happening in real time, you can just sit and watch it. It's a bit like the conversation we had last time about watching the map as you sit on the plane and see how far you've come. You can just sit and watch the lightning map and see what's going on storms-wise in the area that you live in or somewhere else if it's more interesting.
Absolutely. I'm trying to think of maps which kind of like blow my skirt up, which display levels of data. And kind of world classifications of and the spread of languages are one which I always kind of find fascinating. So like the language tree, you start from Indo-European, is always like a fascinating one, but that is like a tree. But then you can see that spread throughout the world, you know, which bits of the world where people speak English as a first language, or all the Slavonic languages, or the language groups of India. I always find it incredibly fascinating because it's incredibly diverse. So I just came back from a holiday in Croatia, and I went to Sarajevo, and that language map is a very contentious one around there, because for nationalistic reasons, the people of Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, and Bosnia say they speak different languages. They're all mutually intelligible. Anybody from any one of those four countries that all used to be part of Yugoslavia can sit in a room and have a proper Barney and understand every word that they're saying. But you speak to a Croatian and do not dare say that they speak Serbo-Croat. They will tell you absolutely categorically, no, I speak Croatian. And interestingly, in somewhere like Bosnia, language is now used as a way of rediscovering nationality and identity, because the Bosnians historically were the, okay, we're nominally Muslim, but we're kind of not, we just accept anybody, people of the former Yugoslavia. And of course, Bosnia is wedged between Croatia and Serbia. And because of the war and because of independence, new loan words from Turkish are coming into Bosnian in inverted commas. But you see that language map and you kind of slightly have to roll your eyes and say, well, okay, you know, this is this bit of Bosnia and they speak Serbian, this bit of Bosnia, they speak Bosniak. But it is somewhat of a political
fiction. So I kind of find those maps really interesting because they don't just tell you about the truth and the lay of the land, so to speak, but also there are political community kind of restraints, constraints, you know, kind of put there as well and stuff. So as I was explaining to somebody, and they were saying, no, I speak a very different language to somebody who speaks Serbian. I says, but can you understand every word they say? They went, yeah, but it's a different language. I went, well, it's not a different language, it's a dialect then, isn't it? We're talking about an accent change. And, you know, it's the same as you and I, Claire, speaking to somebody from the Highlands of Scotland. You know, you might have to slightly tune your ear in, but you can then understand it. And we wouldn't say that somebody from the Highlands of Scotland is speaking a different language.
It just goes to show how easily differences can be escalated into conflict, perhaps, you know.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it goes to the central point I was making. Because of that war in the early 1990s, these constituent countries now say that for nationalistic reasons, that they have their own indigenous language. So you look at the language map down there and you go, yeah, but it's not really there.
Well, it puts me in mind of all the kind of dialect maps you see of Britain where, you know, different ways that people pronounce scone or scone, or what different words people have for the name of a bread roll or a ladybird, and think, just imagine if we all fell into intestine warfare on the basis of how we describe our bread rolls. That would be quite terrifying. That's the future, folks.
It absolutely would. Well, the way politics is going in the Western world, it absolutely is the future, and the future is happening right now. That was Kathy in the Czech Republic, probably our first listener in the Czech Republic. Now here's Pat in Chicago.
Hello, Royfield, Claire, and all other Map Corner pals. This is Pat in Cleveland. Ooh, I've forgotten what information we're supposed to provide on our first call, so I'll just have to be told off and provide it next time. I recently saw a map of the U.S. posted on Facebook showing the most commonly spoken language in every U.S. state, excluding English and Spanish. I might have predicted a few of them, indigenous languages in Arizona, New Mexico, South Dakota, and Alaska, for instance. And it's not surprising that Asian languages are common on the West Coast, Chinese in Washington, Vietnamese in Oregon, and Tagalog in California and Nevada. And on the East Coast, there's French in northern New England, Portuguese in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And those are very old communities there. But I wouldn't have predicted Nepali in Nebraska, Somali in Minnesota, and Hmong in Wisconsin. I'm sure it's because of the U.S. government refugee resettlement program. The government refers refugees to local agencies, and then the agencies tend to specialize. So Somali refugees were originally resettled in Minnesota. Then the resources, such as interpreters, were available. A community formed, and other Somali immigrants followed, even to the cold winters of Minnesota. In fact, there's a new Minnesota member of Congress who was born in Somalia, Representative Ilhan Omar. Last year, the greatest number of refugees to the U.S. came from Congo. Our daughter is a midwife who works for a federally funded health clinic here in Cleveland, and she sees many Congolese, Afghan, and Nepali Bhutanese patients. The map was originally posted by Simon Shows You Maps, and he got it from Business Insider. So I posted also on the Map Corner Facebook group, so you can find it there. Cheers, all.
Oh, thank you for that. And sorry for saying you're from Chicago. And it was actually from Cleveland in the great state of Ohio. Ilhan Omar, she's been in the news recently, hasn't she?
She has.
I had no idea that there was such a concentration of Somalis in Minnesota. You know, it seems like the absolute antithesis in every which way, but, you know, topography-wise, weather-wise, from Somalia. But it shows you how, at least on some levels, how integrated some bits of that Somali community have actually been and how successful they've been, that within, what, a generation, they've got their first congressperson, you know, not only...
Yeah, and I can see how it makes sense in America if you're going to have a asylum seeker dispersal arrangement, that in such a large country, you do allow people to stay close to other community members to an extent by, you know, having concentrations. And we have done similar things in the UK, but not to connect particular communities together, particularly more that there were very limited places that were dispersal areas. So you would get concentrations sort of depending on where people were fleeing from at any one point and what the dispersal area was at the time they arrived.
There's one thing which this map does do is it shows you, in effect, different waves of immigration. Because the other thing which really sticks out for me is that in places like Idaho, Montana, North Dakota, etc., German is the language. And also in the Midwest, so in Indiana, Ohio, and in Kentucky. And obviously that is immigration going way back from the middle of the 19th century, that those communities still have some, you know, some toehold on in terms of language within those states. So I was really struck when I first saw Fargo, which is a film by the Coen brothers in about 1996, the slightly peculiar way that the residents of Fargo speak. And Fargo, I forget whether it's like North Dakota or somewhere, but it's somewhere close to Canada anyway. And they have this Scandinavian inflection. And it's because many immigrants 3 generations ago from Scandinavia, from Sweden and Norway, actually went there. And we can kind of think that America is very monocultural in terms of just the way that English is spoken, but it does have, in various different bits of it, inflections from other languages, which famously down in Louisiana, there's still are some people that speak French. And then more in the more rural bits of Louisiana, there is a French inflected kind of English. But as I said, what this map does show you is the different waves of immigration in the history of the United States. But then also immigration in and of itself. You can have your settler displacement programs, but then also you have kind of chain migration as well, don't you? So that's why you have this Tagalog, which is going to be the Filipino language over in California. You know, those communities aren't part of any resettlement program, but one person comes from the Philippines, quite likes it, then gets their partner or a brother or a sister, and then before you know it, another friend hears about it, and then you get chain migration. So there's 2 different bits of migration actually happening here on this map. And then with waves of migration, whether it is historic, so German settlers in the Midwest in the early 1800s to mid-hundreds, 1800s, or much more recent. So you get Somalis in Minnesota, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and there would have been German speakers who fled the Nazi regime in the early part of the 20th century as well, of course.
Absolutely. So thank you for that awesome map, Pat, from Cleveland. And I should really remember it was Cleveland because I'm a Cleveland Browns fan. Now it's Catherine Rowan-Jones.
Now, is it time for me to decide what people are going to say?
Right, yes. Over to you, boss.
Okay, well, just prepare yourself, because I'm pretty sure that last time we agreed that you were going to put onto the web page,
well, I forgot,
the list of the local national days.
I forgot. Oh gosh, yes, it's me.
So that's what we agreed to do, and that's what I thought we were still agreeing to do, and people could start doing it if only you would post a thing onto the web page.
All right, so that,
so consider this your reminder.
So what about the sign off though, Claire, before it's all my fault?
Okay, sign off. I think for sign off, we could just keep it simple and ask people to just say goodbye. That doesn't sound very exciting, perhaps, but like I would never remember to say I'm folding up my map. I quite like the idea of that, but if people have time for it, that's great. But really, anything that indicates that the call is over works for me.
No, come on.
I'm quite a practical girl.
Why don't we just say, I'm folding up my map? That's beautiful.
Well, there you go. Folding up our map. That's how we're going to finish our calls.
Right. Then what happens if people don't do that? Do we line them up against the wall or what? What happens? What is the sanction? There needs to be a sanction.
You're like a little dictator in need of a country. What's all this about?
Well, no, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to foster community.
By threatening to line people up against a wall? What is this, fascism?
You know, I've just come back from Croatia and there's statues of Franjo Tuđman everywhere there. You know, yeah, our Croatian friends won't like me for saying this, but he was a bit of a watered-down fascist, but that's what he was, folks. But anyway, no politics on Map Corner. All right, so...
I'd like to say that we're a welcoming space and you can as long as you call in, we appreciate you, and you are not going to get lined up against a wall by Roy Field. I will personally stand in the way.
But I didn't say what I was going to do with them when they're lined up against the wall, Claire. Maybe I was going to give them all a stiff handshake or maybe a cuddle. You don't know.
All right, fair enough.
Your mind went to genocidal tendencies. And I think that says more about you than me, actually. But anyway.
nice attempt to dig yourself out of that one.
Catherine Rowan-Jones, over to you.
Good evening, Map Corner. It's Catherine Rowan-Jones calling in from High Wycombe. Don't have my grid reference, but I know where I live, so that's all right. Thanks for name-checking that beautiful map of the Mississippi, a work of art indeed. And the shifting of rivers got me thinking about another transience, which is the phenomenon of longshore drift, notably on the south coast of England in East Sussex, at Rye, where the former large natural harbour, the Chambre, Old French for room, safe haven, experienced a violent storm in the 13th century, which changed the debouching of the rivers Rother, Rye and one other whose name evades me, which then silted up. So Henry VIII's fine sea fort at Camber Castle never fired a shot in anger. Ships were too far out at sea for ever to be a realistic threat. Further along the coast to the west at Pevensey, the Romans built a fine castle on what was then a peninsula in another natural harbour, such a structure that William the Bastard and his conquering force used it as a bridgehead for the invasion. This was an important source of trade in the region, when sea trade was safer than land routes and far swifter too. But again, longshore drift, which is the oblique action of wind on a coastline, I believe, geologists would correct me, caused that to silt up too. And Pevensey Castle is now 2 miles from the sea. Thus passes the glory of the world, along with silt, pebbles and longshore drift, as passes my time and comes quickly to a close. Thanks for everything you do. And remember, a globe has no corners. Love you. Bye.
Wow.
I quite like the globe has no corners as a sign off, actually. I'm coming around to the idea of that.
You know what? I was thinking the same thing. All right. Why don't we just let the two battle it out? Because I quite like that too. So you can either say I'm folding up my map or the globe has no corners. And then we'll see in the fullness of time which one wins out. How's that?
Fair enough.
Smashing.
Okay.
When initially she said longshore drift, I had no idea. And then as soon as you started talking, I did go to Pevensey because I have been there. I took the kids there, 9 years ago or so, when Nonella came over from Canada to see the old Roman. I don't know if there's anything there per se, but it was this was, you know, a Roman fort. It's not like it still stood or anything like that. But, of course, it's nowhere near the near the sea anymore. So what's the difference between longshore drift and just coastal erosion? Is it the same thing?
Well, it feels like the opposite, because longshore drift seems to make things further from the sea, whereas erosion makes things closer. Fall into it.
But it's kind of the same process, though, isn't it? That's kind of what I meant, I think, really.
Or am I just being dim? Is this because I'm too fixated on human geography and cities and stuff, whilst the nuance of all this has kind of gone over my head a little?
Well, I mean, I think it's calls from intelligent people like Catherine that really bring to light the hopeless and hapless amateurism of the two of us when it comes to anything technical about geography. We're just enthusiastic amateurs, folks. Do not look to us for any of the scientific facts. We just like looking at maps.
Mm-hmm. True. True that, which actually does go to highlight the fact that maybe we should get some proper geeks on this.
Oh, yes. So. And that's a great opportunity to say that we were talking about having a new feature on the show, which is going to be Map Fact of the Month.
Oh, okay.
And I was going to do one which I haven't done properly for this time round, but I will. But ideally, what we need is people who are really good at that kind of thing to call in with their map factor of the month. Mm. So I think there's a rich seam of interesting geographical facts which could be little nuggets in the show. So here's a call out for those. Tell us your map facts as well as your map fandom.
You know, if we're just like trying to start random new bits of the show, right? Can we have map of the month, not map of the month, sorry. Can we have flag of the month?
Because nothing works better in an audio medium than just talking about maps and then talking about flags.
Why not? Why not? If we're going to go for it, let's just embrace it.
Is this because you're loving over the Tibetan flag again? Is this a spillover from another podcast?
Well, no, and it's the Nepalese flag, but I'm not going to pull you up about that.
Oh, right, yeah. Right.
But no,
Except you just did.
Yeah. no, traveling to Bosnia really opened my eyes as to, I would say, to the very, I'll call it an unholy mess. That's somewhat over-egging the pudding slightly. The Bosnian flag does not look like a traditional flag. And in terms of vexillology, people always say that the flag of Cyprus is unique because it's the only flag in the world which has a map of the country on. So on the flag of Cyprus, it's white and you see Cyprus and there's some olive leaves. Yeah. Wrong, wrong, wrong. What they've very cleverly done on the Bosnian flag is have the shape of Bosnia on it as a triangle. But at the orientation of where Bosnia sits on a map. So it's blue, the triangle is yellow, and then it has a range of stars. So it looks almost like a knockoff of the European Union flag in that regard, because the stars are yellow with this blue background. Put together, it looks like a 13-year-old has got out a ruler and some star stickers and gone, right, I'm going to make myself a flag here. And how the heck it actually passed the Bosnian parliament, heaven only knows. But it fundamentally doesn't work as a national symbol. It feels like it was created in the 1980s. You know, a flag should have a timeless quality to it. And a flag should always feel slightly old-fashioned, but it has a timeless quality to it. You don't want it to be all newfangled, and this feels like it was newfangled 30 years ago.
I quite like it, but it looks like it was a logo for Blockbuster Video.
There you go. It's the same colours. And you put your finger on it, and I said it looks like it's been designed by a 13-year-old who's got out some star stickers and a ruler or two. But the very fact that you can equate it to a logo tells you that actually it's not timeless. You know, it feels like design as opposed to something which is organically come from history. And that's the thing about flags. Even when they're not organically from history, they should feel like it. And this doesn't at all. And the other interesting thing, so I was looking at it whilst I was in Sarajevo, and you go, you know, this doesn't work at all. But interestingly, they don't have it And a lot of the flagpoles, it's actually ranged downwards. So it's ranged vertically as opposed to horizontally as well, which I think might be a little bit of a Western Balkan thing. Because when I noticed that, then when I went back to Croatia, I noticed that the Croatian flag quite often on a flag post is actually ranged vertically, not horizontally as well. But a lot of it in Bosnia was that way. But I just looking at it, I just thought, nah. This just does not really work, and somebody needs to take the vexillology department of the Bosnian state in hand and say, "Oi, mush, we need to sort this out," because it doesn't project Bosnia and it doesn't project a country with traditions, which is when you go to Sarajevo, you absolutely believe this is somewhere rooted in the tradition of East meets West, the Ottomans and the Austrians and all of that kind of stuff. Looking at that flag, you don't get that sense at all. So if you're just like randomly, arbitrarily, unilaterally having new sections, I say to you, listener, is another reason for you to call in and just say, "Oi, I quite like this flag," and say, "Where the flag, what is the flag of?" It doesn't have to be a country. And then why you like it and what it symbolises to you.
Fair enough.
Great. Now, that's the calls done. Why don't we do the socials?
Okay. So, on Facebook, we've now up to 191 members on Facebook, so we're nearly hitting 200.
Smashing.
So, tell your friends, get that number up. And we've had a variety of things go on there. And in conjunction with the moon landings celebration in the last week, we've had a few people post maps of the moon, including Paul Hahn, who, posted about sort of different ways of mapping the moon over the years. Some really interesting stuff around what people thought the moon was like and how our understanding of it has changed over, a number of centuries, to be honest, to the point where we sent people up to walk around on it. So that was nice. Liz Villalobos sent a really – sorry, you carry on.
Just before we go into Liz and her contribution, I'm all over – the space program and have been, at least I was when I was a little kid, but I must admit I was massively underwhelmed by the film The First Men with Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong. That was dreary and I was so upset because anything to do with NASA, the 60s, space exploration, the Gemini program, the Mercury program, the Apollo program, Buzz Aldrin, all that kind of stuff was like porn to an 8-year-old me. And I still, I'm wide-eyed about what people could achieve, what we could achieve as a species, considering that the power of those computers was less than a modern calculator. And they got there and got back safely. So if anybody can call in and recommend a good film about the space race and about the landing on the moon, not the space race, but the landing on the moon, please call in and tell me, because The First Man, Ryan Gosling, really let me down. Very ponderous, very slow.
Have you seen The Dish, which is not really about the people on the moon, but I quite enjoyed that one?
No. Who's in that?
It's about this satellite dish in Australia, which was essential to beam back the TV pictures of them landing on the moon.
Ah.
It's quite a sort of gentle comedy, really, but it's one to look out for. I quite enjoyed it. And it's, just one of those sort of heartwarming stories about people who went the extra mile and without whom no one would have seen them walking on the moon.
Oh, Rotten Tomatoes giving it 96%. It's good.
There you go.
Roger Ebert loved it too. Good heavens. I'm going to give that a watch. Well done, Claire. So you don't have to call in, folks. No, but please do. Please do. Call in and please tell me. All right, Liz Villalobos.
Okay, so Liz posted a picture that had been compiled by somebody comparing where people who lived locally and people who were tourists took photos. And again, I didn't look too closely at understanding where this data had come from, because I find it a little bit creepy and Big Brother-y. I think it was San Francisco, wasn't it? So it showed different areas of the city. Where do tourists take photos and where do other people take photos? And there are areas where they overlap, but it was quite interesting to see how kind of the bits of the city that were photographed by tourists were not the same at all as the places that were photographed by locals. And obviously you've got more experience of life on the ground there. I don't know whether you've got any sense of whether that
made complete sense, that map. And so it's one of the first things that whenever people come to see me, they'll say, I want to see the Golden Gate Bridge. And you go, okay, but that's out of the way, right? And actually, the bridge which connects San Francisco to Oakland, and I spend a lot of my time in Oakland, is the Bay Bridge. And actually, I think it's a more beautiful bridge, but it's newer. It doesn't have the iconic status as far as the rest of the world's concerned. So you always have to go out of your way to go and see the Golden Gate Bridge. Then you look at that kind of heat map of where tourists are taking pictures. It's the Golden Gate Bridge. It's Fisherman's Wharf. It's the Embarcadero. It's kind of Golden Gate Park. These are not the bits of the city that you as a local frequent. They're just not. So the map complete and utterly plays out. And the interesting thing is as well, is where they did kind of overlap, a lot of it was actually on the ferries. Well, it was in the bay, which is actually the ferries. So to catch a ferry from Fisherman's Wharf, you can go over to Marin, Tiburon, Sausalito, etc. And that's just a lovely thing to do as a tourist, because you see Alcatraz Island, you see the whole of the bay, and it's just blooming beautiful. But people do use that as a commute to and from work. So that's the reason why you had this mingling in the middle of the bay. But yes, first glance, it completely played out in terms of where people in the Bay Area would actually go and take a picture. You know, invariably, you're going to be wandering down Market Street or in the downtown. You're going to go to a bar or something. You'd be there with your friends having a drink and you take a selfie. You know, that's where the locals are going to be taking pictures, or there's going to be some pothole that you've seen and you're outraged and you take a picture and you send it into the council, to the city council. Whereas tourists, you know, it's all about the seals over in Fisherman's Wharf, et cetera. So first look to me, authentic.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. It'd be interesting to see how that plays out for other cities, because there must be places where more people regularly sort of just live, work and do normal stuff like take photos in and amongst tourists. But I guess the pattern will look different from each place.
Mm. Absolutely. Sorry, I just stood up because me watch says I need to stand up once an hour. So I'm just standing up. So why don't you just like crack on with this? And then when my watch tells me to sit down, I will.
Okie dokie. So a couple more from Facebook and one on the subject of the sort of transit maps. Mark Everdon, who's our friend Yoga Bear, posted a London Tube map showing the location of the cheapest pint in a named pub close to each underground station. If you're ever in the need of a cheap pub crawl around London, buy Tube. So again, that's an example. I mean, we spoke to the Londonist mapper last time round, and I think there are loads of fantastic Tube maps showing all sorts of different things. But I'd not seen that one before, so that was quite fun. And also in London specifically, Sebastian Salcedo shared a map around all the bombs that dropped on London during the Second World War, sort of locates all those locations where bombs dropped. So particularly if you live in the city now, you can have a feel for what was there before and what may have been destroyed by a bomb where you are, you know, currently living. So it's always interesting to see how history, you know, can be sort of placed back on a map, and understanding where we, you know, where we understand a place from. So, so there are my Facebook picks.
Matt from the Londonist did kind of talk about that as well, that you can still wander around London and see. It's not as if there are bombed out buildings by any stretch of the imagination, but the ramifications of the German bombing in the Second World War is still writ large if you know how to look for it, which does bring me back on to Sarajevo. And it's like the saddest thing that I noticed a couple of weeks ago is the that city is so not recovered from that war. And I am doing an audio postcard, which about my bus journey from Dubrovnik to Sarajevo. And because it is, it's only, what, 4 hours, but it is kind of epic in many ways, or at least it's symbolic of the change that the geopolitical change that bus journey actually encompasses. But when you get to Sarajevo, there are still buildings, not that many, but there are enough buildings which were damaged in the war, which have not been rebuilt. And we're on about the war that ended in, what, 1995, 1996. But what is absolutely evident is the amount of buildings with bullet holes in them. They are all over the place. And you really realise, you know, the terror that citizens of Sarajevo suffered under, because the Serbs in the hills were just firing down on them. And for the first 18 months, the Bosnians had no army worth talking about, let alone any kind of artillery just to fire back. And you'll be walking down a regular street. We're not talking about in the downtown next to the government buildings, but you just ordinary road. And there are, like, it's just peppered with all these holes. And you go, they're coming bullet holes from like 25 years ago. Yep. You know, and some buildings that they've actually patched them up and filled them in, you know, with concrete and stuff. But those are in the minority. And you just think, crumbs, you know, the economy of Sarajevo, let alone the spirit, was so fundamentally changed by that war. And it's still, is still, you know, trying to recover, really. So, yeah, the marks of war. So, yeah. So that was Facebook. What else you got?
That was Facebook. So on the Map Corner hashtag on Twitter, again, it's mainly me that's posting to that, so come join in. But a couple of things that I would like to kind of flag up that I've been sat there, have been, again, on the kind of subway map theme. There's an amazing visual of a human being anatomy as a subway map. That's what we seem to be believed in, is just showing all the different sort of systems in the human body and how they all connect. And so that's really quite a beautiful thing, but taking the subway map theme. And then I want to do a quick shout out for a map that I posted about the Justice 39, which is an artwork which or a piece of drama which is being put together around the 1919 peace riots in Luton, which is this time last week. I was in Luton Town Centre watching this amazing, art spectacular, celebrating the 100th anniversary of when the people of Luton took against the local council and burned down the town hall. And I think it's been quite an interesting piece of artwork to celebrate or commemorate that, and it's been quite brave on the part of the council to come and commemorate that as well. I was very glad to see they didn't burn down the new town hall again, because that's where I work. but there's a really great map that there's another drama piece coming up next month called Justice 39, which is focused about, you know, what people would change. It's working specifically with young people in the town. But you can see the location where every one of the 39 people who were charged in by the magistrates' court for offences relating to the riot on the 19th of July, where they lived and who they were, and some of the background to their stories. And, you know, it's fascinating to see how, you know, one of the things that really sparked the riot was that people had come back from the war. Obviously, you know, very soon after the end of the First World War, not long after the official armistice was signed and the British decided to call this Peace Day on the 19th of July, and there were going to be celebrations around the country. In Luton, the powers that be organised a sort of a grand banquet. But you had to buy a ticket, and most of the people who had fought in the war couldn't afford one because there wasn't very much work and the people didn't have any money, and they didn't like being left out. So they stormed the town hall and burned it down. And so it's been really interesting to take a look at this map and look at some of the personal stories of the people who got involved. And it's a real mixture of people who've been in the war, daughters and wives and, you know, old and young, just a real range of people. And, you know, there were thousands of people on the street that day when the town hall was burned down, but only 39 were ever charged or taken to court. And I'm sure there's a whole other story around how it was that those other people who felt the hand of justice on their collar, so to speak, in relation to the work. And, you know, there were some people were acquitted, some people were sentenced to, you know, long sentences of hard labour. It's a real mixture. So that was my bit of historical mapping that I wanted to give it a bit of a call out for, because it's been a really interesting story and one that not many people, even who live locally, knew about. And it's been really interesting to see how we can bring that history to life by looking back at, you know, what were the issues 100 years ago and how can we be sure that we're doing a better job now of making people feel heard and feel represented at a local level. So, yeah, I've been really quite proud of the work that's been going on there. So that's my tooting my own horn to an extent, really. Oh, no, but
You toot away. It kind of reminded me of a monument that I saw in Malta, in Valletta last year. And I'm going to butcher the spelling of this, but it basically means the 7th of June. It's like the Sette Giugno. And it's a Maltese national holiday. So you go to Valletta, and Valletta is this ridiculously beautiful, quaint city. And it's like the smallest capital city in Europe. It's only 7,000 people that live there. But Malta itself is like one massive urban conurbation. I say massive, there's only a 500,000 people that live in the island of Malta, but in the nation of Malta. So when you say massive, that's, you know, it's all relative. But it's urban sprawl across this island, but it's kind of beautiful urban sprawl, a sandstone brick, and Valletta is very charming. And I was really surprised to see this monument. And it basically said the Brits killed, like, some people, like 1919. And it really got me thinking that there is, and this is allied to your point about commemorating loss, but it's also to do with that language point that I made before, is that when countries become independent, they look backwards for martyrs, for people who have shed blood for the cause, whether even led directly to independence. And there is something about forging a nation through that blood. And I'd never really thought about this until I heard somebody speak who was Irish. It's a professor, Irish professor, who basically said that the Easter uprising in Ireland was not needed. It was a waste of time. And
And having a scant knowledge of the Easter Uprising when it took place in Dublin, the general population of Dublin saw them as crackpots. But it was a British overreaction subsequently to when they took the post office building back that then there was a wave of sympathy. But he was saying that, you know, and he's Irish, by the way, he's an Irish national. And he wasn't saying Ireland should become part of Britain by any stretch of the imagination. And we had this argument, and I was saying, yeah, but it's a national marker of sacrifice to say that we, the people, whoever the people are, we needed to forge and to fight against the other to solidify who we actually are. And as I said, so I bumped into this monument in Valletta and I thought, bloody hell, I had no idea. And it's not to minimise their loss. We are talking about four people and it was some 50 years before independence. But you're a young, new, thrusting nation. It's almost beholden upon you to go, right, who sacrificed themselves for the idea of this nation, for this people? Mm-hmm. And you go and create a monument. You know, because I'm sure as eggs is eggs, 10 years after the Brits fired into the crowd and killed these four Maltese people, nobody remembered them other than their family members, you know. But it just kind of chimed with me with you saying what you said and then going back to the whole language thing, that if you're going to say that we are independent, we are not part of another polity, almost by dint of that, you need to say, right, here's our flag, here's our martyrs, here is how we are distinctive, language, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah. And it's fascinating in and of itself, and it's also a little bit sad in and of itself as well, you know. But anyway, do we have any more stuff on the socials?
Well, I just want to make a little call out for the Flick app, because that's very quiet. Only launched last month. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where you can not only get the podcast, but also create new conversations about things to do with it. But in order to get going, it does need more members. And there'll be a link, I'm assuming, in the show notes. So it's another place to have those conversations. It can work off your phone. If you're not a fan of Facebook, and not everybody is, then it's an option that doesn't sell your soul to the Facebook empire.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's free of influences from Mr. Zuckerberg. Are we done then, Claire?
I think we are. And we're just going to pick my map of the month. And I think, to be honest, it's the one that shows you all the lightning because it's so cool.
So, Claire, I think it's time for us to fold our maps and maybe to go home.
Yeah, I'm folding up my map. And remember, the globe has no corners? I've already forgotten what it was.
There you go. But wait a minute. I've just thought, is she having a pointed dig at us because we are Map Corner? There's the philosophical, which is the world, you know, the globe has no corners. Then we are Map Corner. Hey, Catherine Brown Jones, you need to come back on here and explain yourself. Are you pointing a finger at us or not?
I think, you know, maybe you're taking offence where none is meant.
Bit like you earlier on, then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free.
That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.